Boston police officer John O'Keefe was found face up in the snow on Saturday morning
outside a home currently occupied by people known to O'Keefe.
State prosecutors accused Karen Reed, who was O'Keefe's girlfriend, of backing into him and leaving him to die in the snow.
Lawyers for the woman under arrest not only say their client is innocent, they're alleging a cover-up.
Her lawyers argue the police report was altered.
Reed's parents and thousands supporting her say there's so much more to this story that doesn't add up.
First got to that scene at 6 a.m. and did not find a single piece of taillight. And then 12 hours later, boom, they found taillight everywhere.
They say there were a lot of people at the home that night, and one of them Googled how long to die in the cold hours before Reed would have known O'Keefe was missing.
My client has no criminal intent. She loved this man.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
An investigation into the death of a Boston police officer in Canton has taken a turn.
The state has filed three oppositions, making accusations against Reed and her attorneys of acting recklessly and intentionally giving a blogger confidential information to taint the investigation.
Team Karen Reed is not backing down.
If you wondered what corruption looks like, that's what corruption looks like.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
So the trial gets underway next week. Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison if convicted of the murder charge against her.
Everybody, every place you go, anyone starts to talk to, they're talking about this.
And those who live in the middle of it all are bracing for a circus.
How dare the prosecution try to prohibit defense counsel from doing our jobs?
The harassment of the witnesses needs to stop.
This is not a Hollywood star. This is an accused murderer getting a standing ovation as she enters the courtroom. What is going on out there?
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is. You know?
Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed!
For anyone who is following this podcast along with the case in real time, you know what a huge week this is. After more than 2 years, the trial of Karen Reed is finally set to start. At the time of this recording, jury selection is finally underway. We have the witness list, discovery list, and more info about how the trial will play out, which means we have a lot to cover, so let's get started. I want to pick up where we left off last week, and I want to talk a little bit about the injuries that were sustained by Officer John O'Keefe. According to court documents, following their initial witness interviews on January 29th, Troopers Buchanick and Proctor proceeded to Good Samaritan Hospital, where John had been taken. Reports say that they observed 6 bloody lacerations, varying in length, on the victim's right arm. The cuts extended from his forearm to his bicep. Both of the victim's eyes were swollen shut and black and blue in color. The troopers observed a cut to the right eyelid area, and Officer O'Keefe's clothes were soaking wet and saturated with blood and vomit. In documents filed by the Commonwealth, it says, quote, "The victim's medical records, attested to by the attending physician and medical personnel, indicate that the victim sustained a right superior orbital ridge region approximately 7 millimeter laceration and surrounding soft tissue swelling contusion, breath sounds bilaterally, pulseless, and superficial abrasions on the right forearm. The time of the victim's death was noted as 7:50 a.m., end quote. John's autopsy was done by Dr. Irini Scordibello. Dr. Scordibello has previously been deemed an expert in forensic pathology for other trials that she's testified in as well. She worked for the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Brooklyn, New York. She received a PhD from the University of Miami, Department of Microbiology and Immunology, and her medical degree from Mount Sinai School of Medicine of NYU. She's board certified by the American Board of Pathology in anatomic and forensic pathology. She has experience teaching and has been published in peer-reviewed publications. Dr. Scordibello conducted the autopsy of Officer John O'Keefe on January 31st, 2022. She advised the troopers that she observed several abrasions to the victim's right forearm, 2 swollen black eyes, a small cut above the right eye, a cut to the left side of his nose, an approximately 2-inch laceration to the back right of his head, and multiple skull fractures that resulted in bleeding of the brain. She also stated the victim's pancreas was dark red color, indicating hypothermia was a contributing factor to his death. Dr. Scordibello opined from her examination that significant blunt force trauma injuries occurred prior to Mr. O'Keefe becoming hypothermic, as evidenced by hemorrhaging in his pancreas and stomach. Officer John O'Keefe arrived at the Good Samaritan Medical Center with body temperature in the low 80s. Dr. Scordibello opined that the extensive injuries to his head likely rendered him incapacitated. She further opined that upon viewing Officer O'Keefe's injuries and her examination of the body, she observed no signs of Mr. O'Keefe being involved in any type of physical altercation or fight. Dr. Scordibello testified to the grand jury about John's injuries. She described his abrasions as, quote, scratches caused by a blunt object, contact with a blunt object, end quote. She went on to describe them as a cluster on his right upper arm and on his right forearm, said that they were mostly linear, ranging in size from a few millimeters up to 7 centimeters. Dr. Scordibello also said that throughout her external examination of John's body, she observed no signs of an altercation or fight. The documents go on to say that Dr. Scordibello testified that from her examination of the victim, both external and internal, that the bleeding and subsequent swelling around his eyes were related to the very small fractures in the skull. She testified specifically that, quote, the injury initiated or started in the back of the head caused all the fractures in the skull, and then the eyes got red or black or purple because of the seepage of blood from the small blood vessels, end quote. According to Officer O'Keefe's death certificate, the cause of death is listed as, quote, blunt impact injuries of the head and hypothermia, end quote. According to the National Association of Medical Examiners, the manner of death for a death certificate can be classified 5 different ways: natural, accident, suicide, homicide, or undetermined. The guide for the manner of death classification that the National Association of Medical Examiners provides states that the cause and manner of death are opinions, so judgment is required to formulate both for reporting on the death certificate. A general scheme of incremental degrees of certainty are listed in this guide. So here's their breakdown. Beyond any doubt is listed at 100% certain. Beyond reasonable doubt is listed as, quote, essentially 100% certainty, end quote. Clear and convincing medical or investigative evidence is listed at about 90% or greater. A preponderance of medical or investigative evidence is listed at about 70% or greater. Reasonable medical or investigative probability is listed at greater than a 50-50 chance, basically more likely than not. And undetermined is listed at less than 50% certainty. For the purpose of the manner of death by the medical examiner, homicide simply means that the manner of death was caused by the actions of another person. Dr. Scordibello listed Officer John O'Keefe's manner of death as undetermined. I mentioned in the last episode that one of the theories presented by the defense was that the injuries to John's arm were from Chloe, the German Shepherd owned by the Albert family, and not from road rash or being struck by a car. Here is defense attorney Alan Jackson.
We hired one of the preeminent medical examiners in the country, a doctor by the name of Sheridan, Frank Sheridan, and he wasn't some deputy medical examiner. Dr. Frank Sheridan was the medical examiner for San Bernardino County in California, with more than 12,000 autopsies under his belt, the supervising medical examiner for one of the largest counties in California, and he concluded to a scientific certainty that these wounds are from an animal attack. Period. Full stop.
In a video addressing the public, Norfolk County District Attorney Michael Morrissey addressed these allegations.
The autopsy of John O'Keefe was conducted by a forensic pathologist from the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. The doctor found that the injuries that left John helpless in the cold were not a result of a fight. She further found that the line of abrasions on his arm was consistent with blunt trauma, not an animal attack.
So if they weren't from an animal attack, that should be the end of it, right? Well, attorney Alan Jackson responds to that.
He said that the medical examiner said this was not from an animal attack. I would highly recommend that Mr. Morrissey actually read witness statements before he starts pontificating about them. Here's what the medical examiner actually said. First, she said that she was unqualified to make a determination as to whether or not there were animal attacks. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Unqualified. And here's your actual statement. Quote, in this particular case, all I can say is that the injuries are there. I documented them. I measured them. But I can't tell you what caused them.
So, like everything else in this case, it will become a battle of the experts. No DNA swabs were done of the tissue of John's arms where his injuries were, but there were swabs done eventually of his clothing. I mentioned in a previous episode that the clothing swabs came back negative for canine DNA. But are those clothing swabs going to be enough to convince a jury of one theory over another? What about the rest of the injuries? There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not the injuries Officer O'Keefe sustained line up with the damage to Karen's car, or if they make sense from being struck by a car at all.
The rest of it on the arms, certainly. If he was crouched over or bent down, you could sustain that from a car.
He was found not in the street. He was found on the lawn, and his torso was pristine. His hip area pristine and his legs pristine.
Generally speaking, if you're going to run over someone backwards, they've got to be at a pretty low position or they've got to be pinned between two objects.
It really depends on the body conformation, the body position, but potentially that forearm could be a pattern from the car.
You know, one of the things that we look for in pedestrian strikes with motor vehicle accidents is we look for something called bumper marks. If somebody is standing erect and they're trying to cross the street, one of the things that you see is that they're struck generally around the knees, that sort of thing. He doesn't have any insults, it sounds like, really inferior to his hips. Everything is kind of taking place up above that.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks. I've worked lots of run over injured people cases. You get hit by a vehicle, there's serious physical damages. You've got a lack of physical damages to the vehicle. You've got a cracked light. We don't have a light that's exploded. We don't have dented body panels. No, we have some really minimal damage on a vehicle.
The federal investigators hired a professional reconstructionist to look into exactly this issue. Did Karen Reed's car make contact with John O'Keefe? And their conclusion to a person was his injuries were inconsistent with the damage on the car. The damage on the car was inconsistent with having made contact with John O'Keefe's body. In other words, the car didn't hit him, and he wasn't hit by the car.
So with all of the conflicting opinions, I wanted to talk directly to an expert to ask his opinions. So I reached out to Dr. Kenneth Kinsey. Dr. Kinsey has extensive experience in crime scene investigation, processing, and reconstruction. He's the owner and chief operator of Kenny Kinsey & Associates, LLC, and is widely recognized as the star witness in the double murder trial of Alex Murdoch. I first asked Dr. Kinsey about the marks on John's arms being from a dog, since he has certification in animal bite recognition.
Yes, ma'am. I am trained in the recognition of. I'm not trained in the actual comparison, you know, with the known and unknown. But I've got that through the Medical Legal Death Investigator Training Academy, my background and my impression evidence training of almost 20 years. So I'm fairly, to a degree of certainty, my opinion is that those are not bite marks.
I also asked if they were possibly claw marks, but Dr. Kinsey did say that he is not certified in the recognition of claw marks. However, he does believe that the marks on John's arm are from a pattern.
They are a pattern injury, however, And like when we mentioned before, there was a couple things that really, really can either make it or break it. And I believe this is one of them.
And when you say pattern marks, can you explain what that is?
Yes, ma'am. The pattern mark, you can tell they're consistent. You know, I've never seen an animal bite with that much distance between their teeth. You know, you've got the incisors, but then you've got a lot of other teeth in between. So I didn't see that. And a lot of times what a bite mark's going to look like, it's going to be two half circles with space in between. And I do not see that there, which tells me, you know, it's probably not a bite mark. But that is a pattern type injury, in my opinion. And a pattern type injury is just, it's impression evidence. It's just like a foot impression or a fingerprint, even if you're going that small. We see them with claw hammers. We see them with baseball bats.
So Dr. Kinsey explains that in order for the prosecution's theory to work, they are going to have to line up those lacerations on John's arm with something either on the car or in the yard.
Something in the undercarriage of that vehicle had to cause that, and you take a known and an unknown, mm-hmm. and or something on the ground, depending on the victim's relative positioning. You know, the force could have been applied to his back, and something on the ground caused that those lacerations. So I don't know about that, but it's going to be one or the other. And if they can't match that pattern type injury up to something, I think it looks real bad for the prosecution.
Another question I had is related to the lack of injuries on Officer O'Keefe's lower body. Dr. Kinsey explains that in order for the car to have made contact with him without projecting him the 8 to 12 feet from the street, the car would have had to have been going at a slower speed, causing him to fold over like a blade of grass as opposed to projecting him back. There's also the possibility of him being in a different position other than standing straight up.
If you're not over the halfway point of that vehicle, you know, if you're over the halfway point and that vehicle is moving fast enough, you're going to do exactly what you would figure in your head or you would picture in your head with a vehicle hitting. You're going to be projected up and over. And then if you're about at that halfway point, you could do what in the old days, Evel Knievel, when he had a bad landing and you see him cartwheel down the road. That's your second option, about midway of that point of gravity, because gravity is always pulling you down. But if you're lower than that force in a slow moving collision of vehicle versus pedestrian, just like when your grass gets too high, and I use this analogy in court a couple times, if just like when your grass is too high and you're mowing your lawn with your lawnmower, it doesn't cut it. It just pushes it down and runs over it. And that could be what we have here, a slow collision. And I'm really not expert, you know, subject matter expert on the how the vehicle is going to notify you or the cell phone things. But the other things I've mentioned, it's just common, simple forensics. If you can't include it, you've got to exclude it. And if you exclude it, then I believe the prosecution's got some problems.
So in order for those injuries to make sense with the Commonwealth's theory, Karen would have had to have been going at a slow speed, which wouldn't project John outward. It would have simply caused him to fall over. And then they would have to be able to match his arm injuries with a pattern of something else underneath the car or in the yard. Dr. Kinsey explained this in an appearance on Court TV.
Snow doesn't put injuries on you and impressions on you. And so either on top of the snow or under the snow, they should find something that corresponds, something that caused these impressions on this victim's arm. And if they didn't find that, this evidence is, you know, only helpful to the defense, in my opinion. I think it gives plenty of reasonable doubt.
Dr. Kinsey also explains in his appearance with Court TV that there probably should have been some kind of injuries on the other side as well.
You ought to have a source that you can attribute to those injuries. You also ought to have some corresponding injuries on the other side. You know, you mentioned earlier he was face up. So there ought to be some type of crushing injuries or something else that corresponds with this.
I asked Dr. Kinsey if the injuries could be consistent with the broken taillight.
You know, even if you don't consider the injuries, I've never seen a pattern injury that you could attribute to a lens. You know, definitely metal. Like I said, the drive shaft, the coupling on the drive shaft, grease fitting. I can't attribute an injury to that, but I do know that those plastics and polymers that different manufacturers use, they have a different makeup, a different recipe, and you may not be able to hone it down to an individual identification if you're missing pieces. If you've got most of the pieces, we have put them together like a jigsaw. Or helped, you know, Highway Patrol put them together like a jigsaw, that, and other trace evidence also. But if you don't have enough, at least you could get a chemical makeup from these companies and include or exclude. You know, a Suburban may be a little bit different than an Explorer. And I don't know if any of that's been looked at. But if those two properties don't match, that's another problem, a major problem. And the only part I can tell you is the forensics part, but I'm sure there are hiccups, you know, all over. And I'm just curious to see how they're going to address them.
I also asked about the injuries being consistent with having been in a fight. For example, the bruising around the eyes.
It can come from the brain injury itself, raccoon eyes, or it could come from a fight. And I'm definitely I would never question a pathologist, you know, on that with my education and my background, but I've seen it both ways. I've seen it in a fight. I've also seen it in some impacts, and I've actually seen it in some contra coup, I believe I said that term right, concussions, where there wasn't actually an impact, but a vehicle made an impact and stopped real fast. And I've also seen that trauma, you know, on some victims. So, not really sure about that. It could be a fight. The injuries on my hand would definitely be consistent with that, but I'm not excluding, you know, an external factor like a collision with a vehicle.
It seems like so much of the evidence presented could go either way with different factors and different opinions from each side's experts. Dr. Kinsey said that this is often how it works with these cases.
I like to remind folks, my opinion's just that. It's just an opinion. And that also goes for a pathologist. You know, you can have three pathologists look at a victim and you can come up with three different cause and manners of death. So, I mean, it's just an opinion. And I'm curious for these details to see where it's going to go and see what they have that maybe they're not sharing, or what, you know, the defense may have, because just having it doesn't mean you know what it means. And so many times right before you get that witness on the stand, you know, something will click and you'll say, wait a minute, this here means this. And you did. You followed the rules of the court. You shared the evidence, but you don't have to share the interpretation. So I'm curious to see.
The questions that we still have are, how did he get 8 to 12 feet from the street without being projected? And where did the skull fractures come from? Hopefully, this will be cleared up at trial. We'll be right back. There's still so much evidence that we haven't seen yet. And trial time is here, y'all. We are officially in jury selection. So, is this conspiracy that the defense is claiming actually legit? Or is there a different conspiracy in Canton?
The state has filed three oppositions making accusations against Reed and her attorneys of acting recklessly and intentionally giving a blogger confidential information to taint the investigation.
The prosecution argues this case should not be thrown out and accuses Karen Reed's team of malfeasance and intentionally manipulating the public's opinion.
The documents allege instead of investigators meddling with the case, Karen Reed and her team of attorneys did to sway the public's opinion, displaying misconduct and ethical violations. Much of that evidence tied to communication with blogger Aidan Kearney, known as Turtle Boy. Prosecutors claim a search warrant of Karen Reed's phone showed that, beginning on or around April 17, 2023, the defendant took deliberate action to start sharing defense theories, privileged materials, and evidence with Mr. Kearney through an out-of-state intermediary. Documents show the next day, Kearney published his first story in support of a cover-up. The leaking of theories, evidence, and more, even coming directly from Karen Reed herself, with investigators stating, call detail records from Mr. Kearney's phone revealed that the defendant's phone number and Mr. Kearney had 189 phone calls between June and December 21st, 2023, communicating for an excess of 40 hours.
The statement, as the district attorney indicated in it, was in response to an extraordinary degree of relentless and really relentless harassment and intimidation of nearly every witness associated with this case, which included a July 22nd rolling rally of nearly 100 people traveling to witnesses' homes and calling them murderers. Now, again, I know the court has read through the Commonwealth's opposition, but just to highlight a few of those particular incidents. So yes, the July 31st, I believe, was the ruling in regard to the, for lack of a better term, a gag order. And I think it's been somewhat inappropriately or just patently falsely represented to this court in public what that ruling said. It indicated that the statements of counsel arguably crossed the line of permissibility under Rule 3.6, and that meaning defense counsel, that the inflammatory statements about the Commonwealth and witnesses, particularly by Attorney Jackson, appear to have fueled much of the publicity in this case, and that's a quote from the court's ruling, and that the defense counsel did not have carte blanche to speak with the media, and going forward, defense counsel should ensure that their statements are limited in conformity with the rules.
You've heard me mention Aidan Carney before, known by his social media following as Turtle Boy. The prosecution has said that the real conspiracy in this case is to use Turtle Boy's following to spread information and make baseless claims in an attempt to shift blame to the witnesses in this case as opposed to the defendant. ADA Lally claims that there has been confidential information that was leaked to Turtle Boy by Karen Reed in her defense, and says that he has harassed and intimidated witnesses in this trial at the request of Reed.
A significant history between this defendant, Mr. Unetti, Mr. Jackson, and the social media blogger, Mr. Kearney, who's now been indicted for intimidation of witnesses in this case. And with reference to that, there is a significant, despite public indications to the contrary, that indications from Mr. Kearney's phone, which was seized, is that there is a precipitous amount of phone communications, indications of communications between Mr. Kearney and Ms. Reed on a signal messaging app, an encrypted app, as well as, I believe, about 189 phone calls over a span of a few months. And that's just what's indicated or contained in the phone. There is also, going back to the spring of 23, direct communications between Mr. Kearney and Mr. Unetti and Mr. Kearney and Mr. Jackson. They went out to lunch with Mr. Kearney following a court date in May of 2023. And this is a person who counsel in the memo seems to want to distance themselves from, based, I'm presuming, on subsequent indictments. But the truth is in the phone. The phone doesn't lie as far as those communications are concerned, as far as those communications between counsel and between the defendant in this particular case. So to say that this is a different case, again, I would suggest, is a large minimization of what actually has transpired here.
So there's a lot to break down here. First, let's talk a little more about Turtle Boy. We've gone over some of this information in previous episodes. Special Prosecutor Ken Mello is bringing charges against Aidan Carney on behalf of the Norfolk DA's office. Mello has said that part of the investigation will include looking to see if Karen may have been involved in any of the alleged witness intimidation, but the main investigation seems to be centered around the allegations of Turtle Boy directly. Mello says that Carney confronted witnesses at sporting events at their children's schools, went to their homes, called them on his live shows, and worked with a local police dispatcher to check the registration for a car parked outside the home of Trooper Proctor. The dispatcher is said to have unlawfully accessed motor vehicle records for Carney and was placed on leave pending the outcome of the internal investigation. On his website, TB Daily News, Turtle Boy wrote an article in September with photos that were taken of a Jeep parked outside the lead investigator Trooper Proctor's home one evening. Turtle Boy says in the article that someone sent him the photo and the Jeep is registered to Matt McCabe, the husband of witness Jen McCabe. This spread like wildfire all over the internet, given the constant insistence from the district attorney's office that Trooper Proctor had no personal connection to anyone in the home. The connection of Trooper Proctor to the McCabes and Alberts is something that is widely disputed amongst both sides. There are clear connections to the Proctors and the Alberts and McCabes. Colin Albert was in Proctor's sister's wedding, and Julie Albert has babysat the children of Proctor's sister, for example. But the arguments have continued constantly throughout the last 2 years as to how close Proctor himself is to the Alberts and McCabes. TB Daily News published photos of Trooper Proctor, which were also shown in court by the defense for Karen Reed when attempting to show the conflict. There's a photo that was shown of Trooper Proctor with his niece and two other young girls. The defense says that these are the daughters of the McCabes, showing a clear conflict. ADA Lally addresses this in court.
There is no conflict. Trooper Proctor is not conflicted in this case. I indicated that specifically in some of the oppositions that were filed to Rule 17. So there's been some photograph taken from a social media site, which is purported to be Trooper Proctor with one of the McCabe's children who are a witness in the case. The child that's depicted in that particular photograph is not one of the McCabe's children. The McCabes have four daughters. That's not one of them. It's a relative of Trooper Proctor. It has nothing to do with the McCabes and nothing to do with this case.
The problem with the way that this was addressed is that Lally says the children and then corrects himself to say the child is related to Proctor, not the McCabes. There's no question about that. The question was brought up about the other two children in the photos, and since that wasn't addressed directly and it was basically avoided, the question remained and the internet stayed focused on it. These photos being published is part of what was also mentioned in the witness intimidation charges against Turtle Boy. Carney says that his actions are protected under the First Amendment, and he maintains that he has only been working to expose the corruption surrounding this case and the people involved. He pleaded not guilty to charges of witness intimidation, picketing witnesses, and conspiracy to intimidate witnesses. Mello also filed a motion alleging that Carney's attorney, Tim Bradle, misrepresented a woman as another lawyer on the defense team, which allowed her to have unmonitored communication with Carney while he was in jail after revocation of his bond. Mello claims that the woman is not an attorney and instead referred to her as a Turtle Boy, quote, follower and minion, end quote, which has become the go-to label of pretty much everyone and anyone who dares to question the pieces of this case that don't seem to add up. Bradle said in an interview to The Globe that it was an honest mistake. The woman should have been classified as a paralegal, but even then, he would have asked that her calls be under the umbrella of the legal team given that role. So, is the real conspiracy actually perpetrated by the defense in an attempt to spark public outrage? In an affidavit filed by the prosecution, the Commonwealth accuses Karen Reed of providing non-public information to Carney while appearing to be distant, and states that she used an intermediary, controlling what he can publish publicly. In an interview with Vinnie Politan, Carney responds to this.
You're using the secret text messaging app that terrorists use. You made 189 phone calls to Karen Reed, and you spoke to her in excess of 40 hours. And then a woman named Jane, who I believe is your ex, stated that you run everything by Karen Reed before you post anything, before you say anything. You run it by her, and you two are kind of in cahoots together.
Well, first of all, I laughed out loud when you said that Signal is a terrorist app. It's one of the most commonly used encrypted apps for a reason, because people don't want Big Brother government coming into their homes with guns, taking their devices and reading all their text messages. That's why people use Signal. And the two sources that they have that the government is using are two of the least credible people on earth. And God forbid, Vinny, that a reporter, an award-winning journalist, speak to the subject of his reporting on the phone. Karen and Reed, yes, guilty as charged. I, as a journalist, interviewed several times and spoke with the subject of my reporting. She asked to remain anonymous, and I honored her anonymity because that's what I do as a journalist. If she gave me information on the record, I reported it. If she gave me information off the record, I didn't report it. Mystery solved. This is an investigation without a crime. This is a pathetic last-ditch attempt by the Commonwealth. They're going down, and they know it, and they're trying to basically smear my credibility and smear Karen Reed's credibility to try to save themselves, but it's not going to work.
Carney went on to say that Karen has absolutely zero control over what he does on his website or what he posts. He said that his endgame is to ask questions and find out what really happened to Officer John O'Keefe, not to intimidate the witnesses so that they no longer wish to testify. Many believe that Turtle Boy has become the face of the Free Karen Reed movement, organizing what he describes as peaceful protests and rallies at the courthouse and around Canton. During one of these protests on November 5th, 2023, a group that has become known as the Canton Nine were approached by Canton police and told that they were unable to protest where they were because they were across the street from the pizza place owned by an Albert. Believing there to be no basis for this, the protesters remained, but left shortly after and no arrests were made. They later received summons to appear in court for potential felony witness intimidation charges and picketing a judge, juror, or court. One of the Canton Nine was a juvenile, and his charges were dismissed in December. For the other eight, this is still ongoing. There are obviously thousands of people who believe in Karen Reed's innocence. And while Turtle Boy has become synonymous with the Free Karen Reed camp, not everyone who believes in her innocence or in the alleged corruption or cover-up is a quote-unquote turtle rider. Social media and independent media seem to be flooded with people questioning what's happening right now in Canton. There are subreddits, Facebook groups, YouTube channels, and TV panels all full of people discussing the case and poring over every detail, trying to get answers to questions and fill in the holes that are left by so many errors and mistakes in court documents and the investigation. There are thousands of people questioning Karen's guilt, completely independent of the allegations of the Commonwealth as it pertains to Turtle Boy and the defense, based solely on evidence, the pretrial hearings, and public records. So if that's the case, it can't all be because of the allegations that Reed and the defense are working with Carney. And just as there are groups that believe that there's no chance Karen is guilty, there are also groups that believe that there's no chance she isn't. Since I started covering this case, I've had more DMs, emails, and contact forms from my website submitted to me than in all other cases that I've covered combined. The majority of them want to ask questions, but they're scared to publicly because asking in public comments invites vitriolic responses. I have talked to multiple reporters who said that no matter what they report as it pertains to this case, they immediately are flooded with angry messages from one side or the other or both. The people who believe that Karen is guilty are outraged that anyone would question otherwise. They insist that the evidence is overwhelming, and they explain away all of the issues that contradict the Commonwealth's theory, often citing the flair of Karen's defense team as the source of any and all such questions, claiming that they have spun a narrative in order to make Karen seem like the victim. The town of Canton has been torn apart and divided, causing rifts in lifelong friendships and distrust in the police. In November, Canton residents voted to audit the local police department. In an article written on Boston.com, journalist Abby Patkin referenced the vote for the audit, stating the debate was, quote, emblematic of the bitter division that has spread through town since the death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe and the murder charge against his girlfriend, Karen Reed, end quote. A special town meeting was held, and the article passed with a vote of 903-800. The meeting lasted nearly 4 hours, and it was so packed that it took up several rooms at Canton High School. The motion calls for an administrative, policy, procedures, and compliance review of the police department to be completed by an independent consulting firm, and the budget for the audit was set at $200,000. Town moderator Alan Hines opened the meeting by acknowledging that there are a lot of people really frustrated with how things have progressed in Canton, and several speakers acknowledge the friction in the town as a result of Karen's case. Tom Birmingham is quoted in the Boston.com article as saying, quote, our town is hurting and out of balance in ways I have never seen before, end quote. We'll be right back. We all know by now that there's a federal investigation into allegations of the police cover-up. I was unable to find any other cases in recent history in Massachusetts that impaneled a grand jury to investigate a murder prosecution before the trial had even started. It's very rare that this happens, and it causes some complications for the Commonwealth. Attorney Peter Tragos is the managing partner at the law offices of Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos, and he has tried cases from federal to state and criminal to civil. He also has a YouTube channel where he covers current cases and trials, reviewing and breaking down the legal side of things for the true crime community that wants to better understand. His father, George Tragos, is a former federal prosecutor and was the chief of the criminal division in the Middle Division of Florida, and is a board-certified criminal trial law attorney that has been defending clients in high-profile cases for more than 40 years. Peter and George Tragos broke down some of the questions about the federal investigation in a show on Peter's YouTube channel, The Lawyer You Know, back in January. Here's a clip.
This stuff does happen. It's not completely unheard of, but it's usually... it's not a good thing, obviously, for the prosecutor if they're being investigated specifically dealing with their prosecution investigation on this case. So it's obviously a negative if it is.
No, there must be something there, because in order to get the attention of the U.S. Attorney's Office, somebody must have given them something that causes them some concern, because they get complaints from citizens all the time, and especially when they're dealing with a state prosecutor. So there's something there that they want to look at.
Right. And again, when you say there's something there, it could be as simple as something that doesn't smell or look right at first glance, that after further investigation, it actually is fine. So just because they do an investigation doesn't mean there's something there as far as criminal activity goes.
So what is it that got the attention of the feds? We know that in April of 2023, First Assistant U.S. Attorney Joshua Levy contacted the Norfolk DA Michael Morrissey's office about federal prosecutors conducting an investigation and witnesses in Karen's case that were subpoenaed to appear before the federal grand jury. Attorney Alan Jackson brought this up in a hearing the following month.
It's been reported that the federal authorities have now gotten involved in the circumstances surrounding this case and have impaneled a grand jury, a federal grand jury, to investigate some of these circumstances. But Karen Reed should not have to wait for the feds to figure out which heads should roll.
That same month, DA Michael Morrissey asked the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Professional Responsibility to look into the federal investigation and requested that it be transferred to another office without any history of conflict, bias, and abuse of prosecutorial discretion because of his past conflicts with former U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins and because of a federal prosecutor whose spouse was a former attorney for the DA's office. This request is denied. The General Counsel of the Executive Office for the United States Attorneys cites no basis for recusal of the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office. In a hearing in January of 2024, Defense Attorney David Yannetti suggested to the court that D.A. Morrissey is the target of the federal investigation.
But it is clear from those letters that District Attorney Morrissey is well aware that he's the target of a federal investigation as a result of his conduct in this case.
In response to this, the U.S. Attorney's Office stated that at this time they had not named any person or entity as the target to anyone. Once again, George and Peter Tragos from The Lawyer You Know.
So, I mean, he said that about as clear as day, that the DA is the target of a federal investigation in this case. And they made some response publicly today, right?
Well, I'm sure that's an exaggeration. Because number one, the state attorney's office, district attorney's office has denied that and said that no one's ever said that. The U.S. attorney's office never, I mean, I can say never, with rare exceptions, do they ever disclose the target of an investigation. And thirdly, the U.S. attorney's office has very strict guidelines about what a target is. And someone gets what's called a target letter only if they're subject to a grand jury subpoena. And if they're subject to a grand jury subpoena, they're labeled the target. And there's a very strict definition of what a target is. So my guess is there's no target wording in any U.S. attorney's letter to the district attorney.
The prosecution requested that the correspondence between them and the U.S. attorney's office remain sealed. However, the U.S. Attorney's Office and Department of Justice responded to the court and said they had no objection to the disclosure of the correspondence.
How unusual is that, Dad? That two prosecutors, right? You would think they're on the same side of the law. They both want to get the bad guy. But the feds are saying, we don't think this stuff needs to be blocked from the public. And the state is saying, we do.
And that's a real clue to what's going on here. Because if it's something if the prosecutor is the U.S. Attorney's Office is trying to keep whatever they're doing secret, they would sure have an objection. There's a lot of times I've appeared in a state court to protect a federal investigation, but they don't even show up and they don't even care that this is going to become public. So that's a real clue. And also that really hurts the prosecutor's argument that this is grand jury material. Because what does this have to do with a grand jury if the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't even care if it gets revealed?
For the entire breakdown of that video from Peter Tragos and his father, George Tragos, you can go to youtube.com/lawyeryouknow. Lally alleges that the investigation from the feds is all because of Karen Reed and her attorney setting it up.
Lastly, what I'll say in reference to the federal grand jury, what is also clear from the federal grand jury is that this was an investigation which was initiated by the defendant and Mr. Jannetty. So to claim that he was in the dark or didn't know about this federal investigation, every bit of discovery that the federal government has from the state case was provided by Mr. Jannetty. Nothing was asked for from the Commonwealth. Nothing was asked for from the district attorney's office, the state police. So, again, what I was intimating before in reference to the motion to dismiss, I have no idea what they have seen or what they haven't seen, how much of the file, how much of the discovery or anything else. It's all sort of been provided and colored by Mr. Jannetty. And this goes back to November of 2022. So to then claim that you were sandbagged or didn't know about an investigation that you initiated over a year before until late in December of 2023 is, I think, disingenuous. Disingenuous would be about the nicest term that I can come up with for that.
Defense Attorney David Jannetty responds.
Focus of Mr. Lally's argument was on everything except for Mr. Morrissey's conduct. Just like it doesn't matter if Mr. Morrissey and his office are actually targets of an investigation, it's only what he knew and believed. Similarly, with regard to his conduct in keeping secret the existence of a federal investigation, it doesn't matter whether we knew about it or not. It's the fact that Morrissey knew, kept it secret for 7 months, and didn't reveal it to the defense until the media got access to those letters. And with that, I would rest.
The federal investigation is ongoing, and it seems that it could really help the defense. In fact, it seems like it already has. The defense has already cited multiple statements that were given before the federal grand jury that directly contradict previous witness statements. They reference phone records that were seized that show that there was contact between Brian Higgins and Brian Albert at 2:22 a.m., though their previous statements claimed that they were asleep and didn't speak that night after Higgins left. They reference times and activities that were directly contradictory to previous statements. And when the defense is trying to show some level of corruption or a cover-up, having more examples of inconsistencies handed directly to them will likely work in their favor. So here we are at the start of the trial. Jury selection is underway, and we are likely only days away from opening statements. In the next episode, I'm going to cover the final pre-trial hearing from this past Friday, and boy was it explosive. But it's also important because it's the final hearing for motions on what will and won't be allowed in trial. And some bombshell accusations were dropped, giving us some insight on what's to come in the next 7 weeks of trial. Could we finally be getting weeks away from getting answers to all of our questions? Could we finally be approaching justice for Officer John O'Keefe?
My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.